crucial historical importance, despite, or perhaps because of the fact, that it has received many different definitions and has been subject to a great deal of theoretical scrutiny, embraced by some, criticized by others, and abandoned by still others. I think it's safe to say that it's a very vexed concept. My introductions will be brief, since I'm sure everyone is anxious to hear our guests speak. This was difficult to do, though, since they're all so incredibly illustrious and have done so much work, but I'll try to be brief. Yvonne Rayner, and we will be going in the order that we're sitting in here, so we should be able to fix a name to a face quite easily. It's the order listed on the advertising for the symposium as well. Yvonne Rayner was one of the earliest and most forceful experimental filmmakers in what is often called the second wave of feminism. Her first film was Lives of Performers in 1972, and in 1974, her film about a woman who had an enormous impact on feminist film scholars and filmmakers. And she continued to explore questions of form and female subjectivity, as well as historicity, in Christina Talking Pictures, 1976, Journeys from Berlin, /1971, 1980, The Man Who Envied Women, 1985, Privilege, 1991, Murder and Murder, 1996. Yvonne bracketed her filmmaking with a career as a dancer and a choreographer. And I like to see this as a brief detour from her real work in filmmaking. but her work as a dancer and choreographer very obviously inflected much of her filmmaking, possibly vice versa. She was one of the organizers of the Judson Dance Theater, which was on the cutting edge of avant-garde dance in the 1960s, and then later formed her own dance company for a brief period. She has had a lasting impact on the aims and forms of modern dance. After the series of films mentioned above, she returned to dance, and you can actually read much more about her current work on the festival's website. Next to her is sitting Yvonne Welben. Yvonne Welben is an award-winning independent filmmaker, educator, and media consultant. She is the director of two films that some of us were very fortunate to see last night, Remembering Y. E. Fang, Remembering Myself, 1995, a personal film about Yvonne's time in Taiwan that activates questions of identity, history, and memory, and Sisters in Cinema, 2000 to 2003, a documentary about the struggles and successes of Black women filmmakers in the face of incredible obstacles. Her film, Living with Pride, Ruth Ellis at 100, 1999, has won 10 Best Documentary Awards, including the GLAAD Media Award for Outstanding Documentary. Yvonne has produced and distributed over 20 films, which have screened on PBS, Stars, Encore, TV One, IFC, Bravo, the Sundance Channel, BET, HBO, and in over 100 film festivals around the world, including Toronto, Berlin, and Sundance. Welben received a BA in history from Vassar College, completed a Master's of Fine Arts degree in film and video at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, and a PhD in radio, TV, film at Northwestern University. She is also a graduate of the American Film Institute's Directing Workshop for Women. Yvonne Welben is currently chair of the Journalism and Media Studies Department and assistant professor of Africana Women's Studies at Bennett College for Women in Greensboro, North Carolina. Next to her is Patty White, who is professor of film and media studies at Swarthmore College and has long been active as a feminist film theorist and as an extremely insightful and astute as well as knowledgeable film critic. She is the author of Uninvited, Classical Hollywood Cinema, and Lesbian Representability, Indiana University Press, 1999. And her articles have appeared in Cinema Journal, GIQ, Screen, and in edited collections Inside Out and A Feminist Reader in Early Cinema, among others. She edited a collection of essays by Teresa De Laredes, Figures of Resistance, Illinois University Press, 2007. She is also co-author with Timothy Corrigan of the film Experience, 2004, second edition 2009, an impressive introductory text that we all hope will rival the hegemonic and dreaded expensive film art and introduction. She is a member of the editorial collective of the most important and influential journal of feminism, media, and culture, Camera Obscura, and she also chairs the board of the nonprofit feminist media arts organization, Women Make Movies. She is currently writing a book on global women's filmmaking in the 21st century. Lynn Joyrich is also a member of the editorial collective of Camera Obscura, and by the way, an associate professor of modern culture and media at Brown, where she teaches television studies, film studies, and gender and sexuality studies. She is the author of Reviewing Reception, Television, Gender, and Postmodern Culture, Indiana University Press, 1996, and of a number of articles and book chapters on film, television, feminist, queer, and cultural studies in various journals and anthologies, such as Cinema Journal, Critical Inquiry, Differences, Discourse, and Camera Obscura, etc. She is currently working on a book on the relation between televisual discourses and the construction of knowledge. Paige Sarlin is a graduate student in the Department of Modern Culture and Media here. She's ABD. For those of you who are not familiar with academic parlance, that means all but dissertation. In her spare time, or perhaps the reverse, she is a filmmaker, activist, and writer. She is the recipient of a Joukowsky Presidential Fellowship at Brown. The working title for her dissertation is Interview Work, The Interview Form and Labor. Her writings on art, film, and politics have been published in the Journal of Aesthetics and Protest, Area, Chicago, Framework, a Journal of Film and Culture, October, and Rethinking Marxism. Since 1999, she has been an active participant in 16 Beaver Group in New York City, a platform for the discussion of the intersection of art, politics, and thought. The last slide projector is her first full-length documentary. The film premiered at the Rotterdam International Film Festival in 2007 and screened at the Anthology Film Archives in New York in 2008. Leslie Thornton, last but not least, by no means least, Leslie Thornton is one of the most prominent contemporary filmmakers. Her powerful images, her commitment to filmmaking as a process rather than a series of closed works, and her forceful interrogation of history, narrative, and biography have been extraordinarily provocative and influential. We are extremely lucky to have her here teaching filmmaking at Brown in the Department of Modern Culture and Media. Her films are too numerous to name here, but some of the central works include The Great Invisible, 2002, Adinata, 1983, and the ongoing series Peggy and Fred in Hell, described by Bill Horgan as the, quote, benchmark work of the decade, unquote. She has received two Rockefeller Fellowships in recognition of her work, as well as numerous other grants and awards, including the Maya Deren Award for Lifetime Achievement, the first Alpert Award in the Arts for Media, a nomination for a Hugo Boss Award, an NEA and NYSCA grants. Her work is included in the permanent collections of MoMA, the Pompidou Center, and others, and is shown at festivals, museums, and galleries worldwide. So the plan here is to begin by having each of the symposium participants speak for a few minutes about the concept of the women's film. And then the panelists will also discuss among themselves some of the questions that have been raised in the presentation. And then we'll open up finally to questions from the audience. Yvonne?
I'm going to read an essay I wrote for Camera Obscura a few years ago. Their issue that was called Archive for the Future. In my performance course at the University of California, Irvine, I have the students read Laura Mulvey's seminal, pardon the expression, visual pleasure and narrative cinema and suggests they present a critique in the form of a pop melody, like Always or In the Midnight Hour or something more up to date. So far, although one student presented a variation on the assignment, no one has risen to this particular challenge. Some of us who were affected by that essay in the mid-70s have never really gotten over it, despite countless subsequent debates around gender-bound identification, spectatorship, and politics of quote-unquote the gaze. Not that I want to quote-unquote get over it, with all due respect to Laura. The ramifications of her painstaking ruminations in the original essay and her subsequent afterthoughts are still provocative, however assimilated, diffused, regurgitated, or dismissed. To invoke Marlon Brando, visual pleasure was to become a durable contender in the feminist firmament, launching 1,000 courses in cultural and women's studies in its wake. I sometimes find myself wondering if it will take something as draconian as the revocation of Roe v. Wade to incite young women to mount the barricades, either intellectually or as activists, with the same ardor and ferocity with which feminist artists, writers, and activists were moved to think and act 30 years ago. The publication of Laura Mulvey's essay in Scream released a cri de coeur that was echoed in protests on both sides of the Atlantic against cultural practices that diminished and marginalized women. In the early 80s, a bunch of feminists got together in New York and thrashed out how best to draw media attention to the threats then looming against abortion rights. Ellen Willis, Anne Snitow, Judith Levine, Tema Kaplan, Carol Vance, Karen Durbin, Alex Gates Schulman, Vanellin Green, Joan Braderman, Sharon Thompson, and I were a few of the writers and artists who met in each other's lofts and apartments to discuss strategies. The older ones shared stories about illegal abortions. Mine of 1959 was particularly illustrative of the punitive attitudes then prevalent, even among medical practitioners who administered the service. A paragraph from my recently published memoir brings my point home. From that. I arrived for the appointed late afternoon procedure at the doctor's ground floor office after his last patient has left. The atmosphere is heavy with secrecy and anxiety. He gives me a local and goes to work. I squeal in pain. His aged Scandinavian nurse tries to hush me, clamps a rubber thing over my nose and mouth, and I start to inhale gas. In a panic, I tear it off and hear her say, "Was your pleasure worth all this?" In my hindsight alternative scenario, I retort, "Fuck you." In mute concentration, the doctor continues scraping and finishes the job. 15 years later, Roe v. Wade will save women from such indignities like this and far worse. We called ourselves No More Nice Girls and proceeded to create a huge banner bearing the slogan, "No More Forced Labor." This we carried during several demonstrations, first in Union Square, later in a mass march in Washington, D.C., dressed in black, our bellies bulging from the pillows stuffed under our skirts, our mouths muted with strips of cloth, our bodies linked with chains. We achieved our objective. The media paid attention and ran photos and TV news coverage of our efforts. In the intervening years, from a feminist perspective, I sensed a complacency and anxious languor in younger women, an assumption that everyone is under the gun equally, men and women. The current ineptitudes, this was during Bush's presidency, the current ineptitudes and proto-fascist proclivities of Bush and company would seem to supersede considerations of gender inequity, which may be appropriate for this historical moment, even as women are sold into prostitution and murdered for dishonor throughout other parts of the world. And yet there is reason to be heartened. In 2004, No More Nice Girls, many of the original bunch with added younger participants, formed a contingent 60 strong to join March for Women's Lives in a massive demonstration again in Washington. The then present danger to Roe v. Wade drew them out. To mark off a field of artistic practice with which I became familiar in the 70s and 80s, I conclude with a yearning for the electrifying fervor, specifically Rose, Anna Carolina, Marguerite Duras, Doris Doring, Chantal Ackerman, Sally Heckel, Sally Potter, Leslie Thornton, Joan Bradman, Sue Friedrich, Marlene Gorris, and Valley Export. Whether or not these film video makers were influenced directly by Mulvey's essay is moot. Its effects had already entered the charged air we breathed. The air I now breathe feels weighted with expectancy. I continue to be buoyed by that history, a history that feels about to erupt again. How did it happen then? What is to be done now?
Thank you. began. The first film by a black woman director was, what we know about, was directed in 1922. And what I'm going to focus on is kind of where we are right now. So one of the things that happened to make it possible for black women to produce films, that we had a lot of technological innovations and grassroots movements that pretty much led to what I'm going to call a democratization of media production. What have these forces meant for African American women in film production today, both inside and outside the Hollywood studio system? In this talk, I'm going to examine how social networking, online entrepreneurial strategies, and other things of that nature have impacted black cultural production, the box office, and also audience expectations. So I want to talk about a couple of things. So one of the things that make possible for us to make films are some movements. So the first one would be the civil rights movement, which, as you may or may not know, helped to create the largest black middle class in the world. And another one of the movements was the women's movement, which, as you know, helped to create what's possible for us to actually produce work, because we were not really involved in the industry as filmmakers so much in the past. Another one of the movements is the LGBT movement, which again allowed some voices to be heard that were not heard in the past. The big thing, I think, that has happened for us is probably why we're even sitting in this room, which is what happened in education, where you had this growth of black studies, women's studies, and film studies, which did not exist before, which allowed for scholarship to happen, for work, for a place for us to actually study the work, a place for us to consider the work. And then the main thing that happened was, well, actually all of these things are really, really important, but technological innovation really, really helped a lot, because it brought the cost of production down so that we could engage in production. We could pick up these tools. And this is pretty much in the 60s and 70s, which I think we're gonna talk about a little bit. Yeah. So, you know, you could actually get a camera in your hand, you could shoot film, you could make a movie. Today, I would say this is actually having a negative impact on production, because even though the cost of production has gone down greatly, we are used to certain things now, like really good sound, which when you don't have a lot of money, you don't have really good sound. So in a way, sometimes psychologically, we're thinking that's a bad movie, but we don't know why, but it's because we used to surround sound, and a lot of times you don't have the funds for that. Okay, so one of the things that's happening with this production is that the cost of filmmaking has really gone up. So these are two black films. One was directed by a black man, which was King Arthur, and the other one was directed by a black woman, which was Talk to Me. And how many people in here have heard of the one that was called Talk to Me? And then how many people heard of King Arthur? And yeah, how many people heard of neither one? Okay, so one of the things that happens for women's production is oftentimes we're not producing the films that are made with these types of budgets, which means that we don't have the marketing dollars that are put into making sure that audiences know about these films. And so what happens is, for a lot of black women, you don't know about them. So you don't know about their work, you don't know what they're doing, and they don't kind of become part of popular culture or our understanding of what film is in America. So right now, the average Hollywood film costs about $70 million to make, and the marketing budget is about $50 million. So if you have women making movies that are less than probably the marketing, well, not even just less than the marketing budget, but I don't even know what the little $4 million budget would be on a film, you're less likely to know about them. So, and this time, I kind of want to focus on this recent wave of independent filmmaking that began in 1986, and it's marked by this moment where Spike Lee made a film called She's Gotta Have It. And what I want to stress is that back then, an independent film was the $175,000 versus that $4 million that Talk to Me was produced for. So those numbers are drastic. What I want to say also is that this movement, this time in 1986, was not the first kind of black independent film movement. The first time was a period that was marked between 1915 and 1950. And that's when you had the majority of black films in this country were made during that time period. And those were called race movies. We had about 500 of them made. And at that time, we had very few black women working in the industry. So my research, I found Tressie Soders, who made a film in 1922, and Maria P. Williams, who made a film in 1923. And these were pretty much wealthy black women. So the early, and then Alois Gist, who made some films in the 30s, I found that the women who made films early on were pretty well off. They were either upper middle class or rich. And, or they, one of the earlier films was the film by, some footage that was shot by Zora Neale Hurston, which is the oldest surviving footage that we have, that was shot by a black woman. And she had a white woman benefactor. So either the women had some money or a white woman helped her make her film. So this this period of early black film was pretty much bookmarked by two court cases. One was Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896, which made segregation separate but equal, like the law. And then 1955, Brown versus Board of Education, that said separate and equal didn't really work. And, you know, it still doesn't. I'm totally skipping over blaxploitation, because, you know, I mean, really. Anyway, so I mean, because we really weren't working then, okay? The black women weren't working then. But when we get to 1969, it's an amazing moment because Hollywood has opened their doors and let a black man in and let him direct the first feature film in the studio system. And black men went on to direct more films. And then by 1991, of the 450 films that were released, 12 were directed by African-American men. So the path for the men has been pretty good. And then we had one by an African-American woman, and we know that that was Daughters of the Dust by Julie Dash. And her film was not directed in the Hollywood studio system. It was an independent film. It took her about 10 years to raise the money for that film. And her experience was very different for what was happening for the men. You may know some of these names: John Singleton, Ernest Dickinson, Charles Burnett, Carl Franklin, F. Gary Gray. All of these men were working during that time period. They've made lots of films. In this period, from in the 1990s, where all of these men were working, they directed, let's see, I think I have about close to 200 films, whereas black women during that time period directed 20. Okay, so one of the things that was happening was, I have a quote from Casey Lemons, and she was the woman who directed Talk to Me. And she said during that time, she said, well, you know, I think this is a really important time. We're finding this wave that the brothers found 10 years ago that Spike Lee helped to create. I think we're on this wave, and I think we're about to explode. Okay, it didn't happen. So, and I'm just jumping around through this. So that's Casey there. So what did happen for African-American women? So from 1896 to 1989, we have eight features that from 1990 to 2000, we have 26 features that were directed, and from 2001 to 2008, we have 36 features. So we haven't made that many films. And if you just combine, do you all know who Oscar Micheaux is? Oscar Micheaux was the most prolific black director during that race movie time period. If you just combine his work, and he did like 45 features by himself, and Spike Lee's work, two men have directed more films, two black men have directed more films than all black women combined.
Is that cumulative or is that?
Each period, so you can add it up. And that's cumulative. And I think there are a few more that were added in 2009 and 2010. Probably you can add 5 to that number. Okay, so, and the thing is, back 10 years ago, I was thinking, okay, so Hollywood's not interested in black women, and so therefore, they're gonna keep making these independent films, and we're gonna have this explosion of work, and like I said, it didn't happen. What did happen was that Hollywood pretty much changed in this kind of, you know, everybody's talking about this post-racial time, which, you know, I don't know if that's true or not, but what did happen was that black directors were allowed to direct films that didn't have any black people in them. So there was this acceptance, and it happened for the men and for the women. So you've got Paul Franklin directing this One True Thing with Meryl Streep, and you have Angela Robinson, who is the second black woman to, second African-American woman to direct a Hollywood studio film, where she directed Herbie Fully Loaded. She says that they didn't let her have put any black people in it, and she would explain it to me over coffee one day, but we haven't had that chat yet. And this was the largest, this is the film with the largest budget that a black woman directed. It was a $70 million movie. And before that, she directed Debs, which, again, there is a black woman in the film, but she's not the lead character. She's that, you know, the new term they're calling the black best friend that a lot of these films have right now, where you have this really supportive black woman who's your pal and helps you through everything. Well, anyway, so she even had one in her movie. So, and we also have Cheryl Denier, whose film The Watermelon Woman was also the first black feature film by an out African-American lesbian, and her success also led her to be able to direct, I don't know what you want to call My Baby's Daddy. For My Baby's Daddy or for The Watermelon Woman? The Watermelon Woman was, the funding came about the old fashioned way, which was kind of friends and family support. She also collaborated with an artist named Zoe Leonard, and they created a series of photographs. She received one of the last NEA grants, which caused so much controversy that I think Alec Baldwin, was like advocating for her. She's like, this white man is fighting for me. Because they felt the film was pornographic, which it isn't if you've seen it. So that film budget was probably it was under $200,000. My Baby's Daddy takes her to about $25 million. But this is the thing that happened. So you're looking at these black women, they were kind of embraced by and this is a Miramax film, so it's a mini major, not a major studio, embraced by the studio system, but they're not making their own work. In this case, she did work with My Baby's Daddy. She did work to kind of add a lesbian twist into one of the women who was with the baby's daddies. And so here's some more films that black people got to direct. Okay, I'm gonna stop there because this isn't part of this talk. But basically, we're not making work in the way that, and opportunities that men are having across the board. And so even though I'm saying this about black women, this is, I don't care what your race is, this situation is what's happening in the industry for all women. So the numbers that I, you know, giving you, like the disproportionate number of what a black woman can do with a black man, it's probably worse for white women and white men. Because the I don't know, are you doing stats?
I don't have to know, but I know the
7%. So the 7% stat, which is that women are 51% of the population, but we are directing 7% of the films. And in Hollywood, in our country, African American men are 6% of the population, and they are directing 6% of the movies out of the industry. And back in the 90s, in 91, where I showed you that quote where it was 12 black men, there were more black men directing films than women total in that year. And there are a number of men who made reference to that. But anyway, so those are some of my opening comments, and we can move on. Thank you.
Some of the editors left, and
1975. You can just read it up there. I just picked up some highlights of things that were happening and films that were happening. So I think that first program at Edinburgh was a mix of stuff. There were some silent films, there were some rediscovered directors, there were some art house directors from the continent. I think Nellie Kaplan's work was featured. So it wasn't that different from what we're looking at here, except for, of course, we have newer work to draw on. But there is a strong strain of those 70s classics here. Work by Duras, by Ulrika Ottinger, Yvonne Rayner, Shirley Clark's even older work, Marjorie Keller. And I was thinking it must be just sort of classroom burnout that means that we don't have Sally Potter, Chantal Ackerman, and who else? Oh, and Dorothy Arzner. Because women's film.
We did have Arzner. Dance Carlton.
Okay. We never have enough. But I'm just saying that those names really, for a reason, became very important in as feminist film culture grew around scholarship and around these organizations and programming initiatives. So this look back at the 70s is not an isolated thing right now. We've just seen the release of, this is just some more 70s happy women photos that I found. These are all the Women Make Movies files. This is Women Make Movies flyer to Come and Make Movies, which is what the organization did at the beginning before it became a distributor. But you can see there was really a focus on class, bilingualism, and younger women. So it was really about a neighborhood filmmaking venture. And there were many, many, many such sort of like, let's learn how to use this lightweight equipment, let's tell our own stories, let's intervene in the media at that time. And of course there's a whole range. I just mentioned very aesthetic, very festival worthy long works by women directors, but also there's activist work, there's documentary, lots of stuff happening. So I was just saying that the 70s are sort of, there's a kind of moment of looking back. Joan Reiterman's Collective has recently been released. Lynn Hirschman-Leeson is finishing a film called WAR, Women, Art Revolution, about the feminist art movement. CLAGS last week had a conference called the Lesbian 70s, which people got out of. I think it's now not the Lesbian 70s anymore. MoMA just concluded a retrospective of Barbara Hammer's work. And I think in terms of exhibition, Barbara Hammer couldn't be more typical of the kinds of alternative exhibition practices that were around women's filmmaking in the 70s, because she made lesbian films with her friends that were often shown to her friends in separatist venues. That isn't to say that filmmakers like Barbara Hammer or Vaughn, or who have infiltrated all the highest cultural institutions of the land, it's still, for experimental filmmakers, these kind of creative exhibition sites are still really important. But in the 70s, these women's film festivals took place in the context of all kinds of activity in women's film. And I think, I guess some of the examples, another picture from Women Make Movies. One more thing I wanted to say about movie from the 70s is kind of getting access to the work when you read these programs, and there would be just this desire to track down this short film that was screened, and you just don't know where you'd ever see it. The Women's Film Preservation Fund at NIWF, which is a New York Women in Film and Television, has been restoring work, and they take proposals for different kinds of work, but that's where I saw Jesse Maples. So they're just doing just a restoration of Jesse Maples, so Black woman director, and they're also restoring some short films like Betty Tells Her Story, a film by Marguerite Paris. These are films from the 70s women's movements, the sort of documentaries that Claire Johnston and other sort of theoretically oriented feminists were thinking were so sort of naive in their politics, but now are just these total invaluable records, and also have the same kind of less, sort of 70s fashion look. They're not transparent because you see them from this distance now, historically. But I also wanted to point out in my examples that it wasn't just an Anglo-American movement, cine feminism, even though that was a large part of what was happening, that there were women involved in post-colonial filmmaking movements, women of Sarah Cine, Sarah Gomez, I quote her, or I cite her in making films in Cuba, in Algeria, and Senegal. Now these have interesting transnational dimensions, these ways that film culture flowed as well, colonial ones, other kinds of alliances, political alliances. But I think it's important to remember those transnational dimensions of the women's movement in that time, in the histories that we draw, in the genealogies that we draw to the present. So I wanted to cite something else from Care Obscure. It's becoming self-promotion. But Kathleen McHugh wrote an essay called The World and the Soup, and you have to read it to figure out why she called it that, about the contribution that women born before 1960, I think is her cutoff, basically women born at a time when there was a lot of interesting innovation in things like the Women's Film Fund in Australia, around feminist agitating in the media. So there, the feminist politics permeated that generation and actually transformed film culture in ways that have yet to be adequately historicized or and known. So in the 80s and 90s, we know that women of greater diversity produced feminist work of greater range and quantity, so much so that there was much less kind of symbiosis between what we did at Camera Obscura and all the work that was out there. You couldn't like write an essay for every, you know, new great work of feminist film that came along because there was just so much, and because that would be a kind of, you know, hegemonic version of like, let's just pick the ones that are going to be in this history. But also feminist film studies became institutionalized. I mean, it became an institution. So in her 2002 book, Women's Cinema, The Contested Screen, Alison Butler writes, quote, "The plurality of forms, concerns, and constituencies in contemporary women's cinema now exceeds even the most flexible definitions of counter-cinema. Women's cinema now seems minor rather than oppositional," end quote. So she's using minor in Deleuze and Guattari's sense of minor literature, sort of dispossessed, politicized, collectivized practice within the dominant culture. So, you know, she says, don't misrecognize that. And she continues, and I'm quoting this because I think it's a good, it's always helpful when I'm having discussions with students about women's cinema, how she kind of makes this new. "Women's cinema is well placed literally to address transnational processes. As a minor cinema, it inhabits cultural and political formations without being entirely naturalized there. And at the same time, exceeds them through its lateral affiliations. Its usefulness resides in precisely these qualities. It exists only in the eyes of its beholders, crossing boundaries between forms, periods, and cultures to engender feminist communities." And that's from her, it's a Wallflower book. It's a great little teaching text, but it's got good theorizing in it too. That's from the end of the book. So I agree that obviously universalizing gestures have been very costly in women's film culture, as they have been in other realms of feminist theory and activism. But this understanding of women's cinema as only in the eyes of the beholder, I think doesn't take into account the horizon of women's cinema that Teresa de Laredes called an aesthetics of address in her essay Rethinking Women's Cinema. So without thinking in both ways, that it's in the eyes of the beholder and there's some formation or some horizon there, I think we do end up seeing women's cinema as minor in the ways that Yvonne was tracking. If it isn't written about, if it isn't publicized, if it isn't shown as such or in relationship to other things or historicized, then it disappears, especially in the sort of digital era smorgasbord of images. Over this period, then, women's film festivals did become much less significant. Within the ideology of post-feminist culture, quotes, women in the developed world are seen as having it all, even their own media. So you don't need your own separate media because you have, you know, things to choose from as a consumer. So as we know from feminist film theory, even chick flicks are as much about what we lack as what we have. So in other words, they're not about having it all at all. And they coexist with many other kinds of women's cinema now. So far, we're told 2010 is a banner year for women's cinema outside that genre of chick flicks. So Catherine Bigelow won the first Oscar for Best Director. Sofia Coppola just won the Golden Lion, the top prize at Venice. industrial films by women, I think, do have, industrial like Hollywood, but also other national film industries, I think do have increased access to screens within what we see as a dizzying proliferation of film festivals and festival networks in general. So not women's film festivals, but elsewhere. The festival circuit has made it possible for people to make first, sometimes second features, for national cinemas to circulate transnationally in ways that they didn't before. But that women's film festivals are not in that same logic, partly because there's no real market logic driving women's film festivals. And I think that's a little bit different from LGBT festivals, which increased during the period when women's film festivals disappeared, and they increased because of activism and AIDS activism and, you know, artistic just flourishing, but also because of market wisdom. I mean, really, and that's globally. So even as women's film festivals are virtually invisible, amid the boom in scholarship on festivals, there's very little on women's film festivals. So the bibliographers Scandi Most and Marika DeValk have an online bibliography of festival studies, and there's just like two entries for women's festivals. So this is for people here to do. Kay Armitage provided a history of the 1972 Toronto Women's Film Festival as a sort of beginning of, to address that in a festival yearbook. So I'm just going to talk about the festival about, but I don't, but women's film festivals do exist. So I'm just going to use this as kind of a quick slideshow of a web, of sort of a, you know, hit and run web search of some of the festivals that I want to talk about. Because there's significant histories to be studied. This, the Taiwan event, is going on right now. And it's its 17th edition. And it's really, you can do an English version of the website if you go there. But to study the well-established and government-funded Women's International Film Festival in Seoul, that's this one, the politicized traveling Fillmore Festival in Turkey, the media-savvy Bird's Eye Festival in the UK, or the loyal audiences built up by the longevity of the events in Hatay, and Taiwan requires more than tracing an unbroken history from that Edinburgh Women's Film event, obviously. It is part of the genealogy, but one needs to look at national and regional industries and political histories and post-colonial realities alongside these histories of cinefeminism and feminist film theory. So it's just really interesting to see, like in Korea, it's government-funded, as I said, but there's a lot of younger audiences that wouldn't probably identify with feminism, but the people who program it are very, are academic feminists and very interested in, you know, cinefeminism. They did a big conference on cinefeminism. And they, the audiences are very different in different places. So I think festivals by definition foster the transnational, because you see that the premieres of each year might show at every one of these festivals. But that kind of circulation isn't exactly the type of feminist connectivity that Inderpal Goel is talking about when she talks about transnational feminism. But I do think we can do that work to make those things visible. So as films are brought into contact with local sites and histories, new meanings are projected. So well, I just want to give as an example, because I work with Women Make Movies. Oh, there's the last festival I need to do a shout out to. So Women Make Movies distributes scores of films that are made by women outside of the country to the US. But Women Make Movies is also increasingly called upon to curate and exhibit work at festivals all over the world. So there's these two dimensions of sort of a transnational traveling of that particular repository of feminist film culture. And I think attention to festivals and exhibition sites can illuminate the power and politics embedded in these kinds of flows. Festivals and classrooms where women's cinema remains a vibrant, contested concept. So festivals in classrooms where women's cinema is still a vibrant, contested concept allow us to engage ethically with films and videos that trail their places, times, and publics with them.
So I am not a film or video maker, but a film and TV So you might ask, you know, what in the world am I doing here on this panel? Well, just to some degree, I'm going to continue talking about a lot of things that have already come up. But what I wanted to talk a little bit about today is precisely the relationship between those categories. So between film and video making and film and video analysis. In other words, between theory and practice. That, I think, is a really ideal topic for us here, since we're at a place defined by that very relationship, right, given the Department of Modern Culture and Media's investment in both theory and practice and in their connections, right? So the way the department is so focused on the way that we can try to think each of them through the other, thus hopefully fostering the most creative analysis and the most thoughtful productions. It's also, I think, a crucial topic for the MCM Women's Film Festival especially, because I think that the connections between theory and practice seem to be particularly important in women's production, given the way historically that women's both intellectual and creative production have been downplayed and dismissed, and often sort of by using the other against, you know, by using each of them against one another, right? So by using intellectual claims and creative claims against one another. So for example, women's creative production has often been historically dismissed as sort of not smart, right? Not innovative, not intellectually as vigorous as men's, not technically or theoretically or historically informed, not showing the same signs of education or expertise. Or sometimes you get the opposite of that, where it's just seen as, you know, just kind of baldly translating theory into practice, but with no aesthetic vision of its own. And then simultaneously, I think women's intellectual production has often been dismissed as evidencing maybe a kind of artful construction, a kind of feminine intuition, but not reasoned argument or solid logic. So, you know, maybe nominally creative, but not really cerebral, right? Or again, sometimes the reverse, that it just mimics male logic and attempt to get legitimacy, but without any creative thought of its own. So given those kinds of discourses and judgments, I think it's really crucial that we not only recognize women's both creative and intellectual work, but the relationship between the two, right? So that the way in which developing new ideas means developing new ways of seeing and representing, and vice versa, that ways of seeing are ways of knowing. So in other words, what I'm trying to say is that breaking down the boundaries between theory and practice is just as key to the feminist project, I'd suggest, as critiquing and deconstructing other boundaries that have been so central in feminist work, like the boundaries between mind and body, or subject and object, subjective, objective, reason and emotion, universal and particular, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, of course, precisely because attempts to shift or break down those polarities have opened up new terrain beyond the boundaries, we can't really speak of the feminist project anymore, but of feminist projects, right, the multiplicity of work that exists across that terrain. So I do think that it's important to look at this multiplicity. But I do want to say just a bit about one such project, one aspect of my work that's, you know, come up a lot already, and that's the work of the journal Camera Obscura, with which I'm involved, along with my co-panelist and fellow Camera Obscura member, collective member, Patty White. So Camera Obscura is, as I just indicated, a collective, that it operates through the labor of a small group of co-editors, a group that's shifted over the years since the journal's inception. It was actually formed by a group of University of California, Berkeley graduate students in 1975, with then the first issue coming out in 76. And as many of you know, that journal, you know, from that beginning was very committed to producing and disseminating feminist film theory with a lot of very highly influential texts in, you know, what has since come to be the canon of feminist film studies, first published actually in its pages, right? And of course that includes texts by some of our very panel members, like for example, Marianne Doan. So in fact, the journal gained a reputation for being sort of the site for theoretical work in film studies, and work that, you know, tried to meet all the requirements, work that was both informed and inventive, rigorous and visionary. But that kind of inventive history didn't only reveal the richness of feminist film theory, right, didn't only promote and enact women's and of course also many men's intellectual production. It also tried to reveal the richness of feminist filmmaking, also trying to promote and support women's artistic media production. From the very first issue of the journal, women filmmakers were showcased and introduced to the journal's readers. In fact, issue number one featured Yvonne Rainer with descriptions and analyses of her work and an interview with her, etc. Other women filmmakers discussed in the early issues of the journal include Jackie Raynal, Chantal Ackerman, Marguerite Duras, Babette Mangold, Sally Potter, and over time, many, many, many others. So in fact, in its commitment to showcasing that kind of work, right, the journal not only included individual articles on some of those filmmakers' productions, right, as well as, of course, articles on many other topics of import for feminist analysis, but by, you know, even by just its second issue, it already instituted a special section of the journal that was entitled Women Working, that was designed as a site specifically designed to get information out to readers, you know, relatively quickly via short form essays about current work by women media artists. So in the very makeup of the journal, then, you see a commitment to integrating theory and practice, both feminist theory and then the feminist practice of the collective, and then also film theory and the practice of filmmakers, the filmmakers highlighted. And that kind of integration, of course, was mutually beneficial, provided kind of reciprocal support. So in other words, the work of feminist film theory helped to produce an atmosphere, hopefully, in which women's filmmaking could further develop, right, even just by letting people know about those films so that they would rent them and teach them, you know, bring filmmakers to their campuses in their cities to speak and show their work, organize film festivals, promote the artists, et cetera. So, you know, promote it that way, and then, you know, the reverse, seeing those new kinds of envisionings on the part of filmmakers, right, also helped theorists push their own analyses, develop and push their own models. So on all levels then, intellectual and institutional, practical and pedagogical, right, creative and critical, the connections, the dialogue between feminist film studies and feminist film practice, right, were and still are very deeply important ones. Now arguably though those connections have shifted, as people talk about, shifted over time as both theory and practice have shifted. So the filmmakers on the panel obviously can speak more to how the world of filmmaking changed, right, with changes in technology, changes in sources of funding, changes in institutions of production and distribution and exhibition, and, you know, not necessarily changes for the better, right, so that even as some women filmmakers were managing finally to get visibility in the industry, many other institutional and financial supports for women's film, particularly independent film, were dwindling away. Similar tensions also existed in the realm of theory, right? So feminist film theory was getting, you know, more visible. Some approaches really becoming very ensconced in film studies programs and canonized in the academy, even as more and more debates were emerging about just what counted as feminist film theory, as those debates were emerging. And again, Cameron Tier, I think, can serve as a marker or example of that. As the journal continued to gain recognition, right, getting that reputation for being, you know, the site of high theory in film studies, it also started shifting its notions of theory, right, that it broadened its interests and investments also to other media forms, not just film, and to multiple modes of theorizing media. So, you know, no longer just focused on film, Cameron Obscura started publishing pieces on television, performance, photography, surveillance and medical technologies, new digital media, and so on. And so it indicated both, you know, explicitly in certain published arguments about that, and then just implicitly in what it included, right, it suggested that those different media forms can't be isolated from one another, right, especially, you know, if we want to try to best analyze the complex and multiple ways in which different media forms intersect with gender differences and sexual differences. And likewise, Cameron Obscura was no longer just focused on psychoanalytic or textual theories, the ones that really defined its initial scholarly investments, Those theories did continue, they still continue to have an important place in the journal, but now, you know, so did historical and contextual analyses, cultural studies, work in audience analysis, studies of technology, studies of the body, work mostly influenced, let's say, by queer theory or critical race studies or theories of governance and globalization, et cetera. So a lot of different kinds of intellectual concerns and research traditions, philosophical perspectives, methodological approaches, and so on. Still, the commitment to feminist theory and feminist practice and to their intersection remains, even as that both sort of broadened yet also more fragmented outlook brings its own challenges of trying to figure out, again, just what feminist theory or feminist practice even mean anymore. And in fact, that question emerged in quite a pressing and interesting way in regard to a new project that, you know, whether appropriately or whether vaguely or whether appropriate in its vagueness, we came to call In Practice, about, you know, just what is practice. Now, I said that that was a new project of the journal, but actually it wasn't really so new. It was the current editorial collective's attempt to revive that older section that I had mentioned, Women Working. So we decided, and I should say largely due to Patty's wonderful encouragement, we decided that it was important really to revive that section that had faded away, and through that revival to try to, you know, insist again on the importance of bringing attention to women's ongoing media creation, right? Not just to analyzing what was now sort of the canon of films, both Hollywood and independent, that, you know, had become already classics of feminist film analysis or staples of the journal, you know, but we wanted to continue to both sort of deform and reform that canon by bringing new people, new texts, new issues into the conversation. You know, but in the light of the theoretical changes in the journal, again, that meant bringing in precisely new subjects, new modes of representation, new media, new issues that these texts in production were addressing, right? Even new ideas of, you know, what counts as a text in production. So that led to some very interesting discussions and debates among the collective members. As a collective, we were committed to working through those debates, right, that we had our model of working through issues that came up, but, you know, the issues that were raised were tough ones and telling ones, right, tough because they were so telling. So, you know, we debated, well, should we reinstitute the title Women Working with the demarcations that that seems to imply? We all agreed that we definitely wanted the journal to maintain its commitment to feminism, right? That was the one constant of the journal, even literally in the sense of being the constant thing in our subtitle. That Cameron Stewart was first had the subtitle A Journal of Feminism and Film Theory, then later when we changed it in 1995, it still had feminism in it, but now it was Feminism, Culture, and Media Studies. So we have that ongoing commitment, but, you know, did that ongoing focus on feminism mean necessarily an exclusive focus on women for that section, right, as in Women Working? Or did it mean considering, you know, not only work that might construct new notions of women, but did it also mean, well, we should also have work that deconstruct ideas of gender identification, right? In other words, would we want a title, you know, wouldn't that mean a title that didn't specify work by the identity of its producer? And again, to be clear, not because we were, you know, afraid of offending men, it wasn't some abstract sense of reverse sexism, but, you know, because in a very material lived sense, we didn't want to offend our own versions of feminist theory or queer theory or trans theory that, you know, and so on that we were committed to. So all these issues raised about, you know, should we identify it by identity? Beyond even the issues raised about the women part, right, also, you know, what about the working part, right? What counts as work in media? What counts as practice, as production? Did that only mean the work of film and video makers? What about the work of film and video viewers, for example? The work of re-articulating media text that occurs, you know, when they're taken up and discussed, when they're collected in festivals, when they're archived, when they're reviewed in critiques, or when they're rewritten in fan productions, for example. So we wanted to encourage all sorts of those kinds of productions and practices. We wanted to encourage ever more transformations in what can operate or even register as production or as practice. So therefore, we came up with our In Practice name, and with a description that we hoped would be open to a whole variety of things. So you know, reports on film and video work in progress, but also think pieces on what such progress might even mean in different global or local contexts. Maybe interviews with professional media makers, but also with amateurs, right? So, you know, in defining, you know, media pretty broadly, so even things like, you know, people making YouTube videos. Reports of film festivals, but also reports of things like fan conventions, right? So in sum, we wanted to really be open to discussions of various groupings, of various kinds of texts and practices across different archives, different forms, different cultural and subcultural traditions, et cetera. Now, this isn't to say, certainly, that looking at women in film, as we are doing at this festival, does not remain, you know, a fascinating, important, itself transforming undertaking, right? It most certainly does. And I think particularly as it's occurring, for instance, in a festival like this that really tries to emphasize the richness and diverse scope and history of that undertaking, right? So Camera Obscura, as I said, was founded precisely to be a part of those kinds of endeavors, still very much committed to that, you know, to fostering both theory and practice, and like I said, their intersections. But again, it's trying to really generate new productions, both intellectual and creative, in media making, media viewing, media analysis, media activism. So, you know, work like that, the work that's shown throughout this festival, I think is a really key component of it. So again, you know, thanks so much to all the filmmakers for making it and for the festival organizers for bringing it. But, you know, also I think important is the work and the pleasure of viewing and thinking about and discussing these films. So thanks also to the audience for that. So it's precisely the kinds of contacts and connections between that that I think puts all of us sort of in practice for the ongoing work that we all have to do ahead. So, and I'm very grateful to be a part of that. So, thank you.
I'm already amazed by how much I've learned in the last hour and a half. These are just some thoughts. In my choice of documentary subject matter and scholarly pursuits, I always find myself most fascinated by historical continuities and shifts in labor practices and modes of cultural production. So my way into thinking about the women's film has been through a practical and theoretical consideration of changing definitions, analyses, and representations of work and labor, and specifically of women's work. And this is kind of an American-centric, but I think the comments about the global will fit in, intersect with this pretty well. If we begin with the premise that Hollywood and independent media production of all kinds constitute the largest private sector industry in the US, then it's actually important to think for a minute about what it would mean to think about the women's film or women's media even more broadly, not simply as a matter of the representation of women, but rather as a gendered form of work, both in the sorts of labor involved in media production and distribution, as already been talked about, from acting to producing to directing to fundraising, promoting, and teaching, arguably, to the gendering of the labor of consumption and the unpaid labor of media consumption, but also the paid labor of curating, analysis, the informal labor of content providers on the web, whatnot. To me, this intersection between women's work and the women's film is why the category of the women's film is still a compelling theoretical or conceptual term. Because in its simplicity, it refers to three aspects of representation, production, and consumption. The question of how this collapse and amalgamation operates or can be made to operate is something that seems particularly timely and important because we are in the midst of the most massive economic crisis brought on by over 30 years of neoliberal practices in which social welfare and social services, including national funding for abortion, have been eroded, and the American working class's wages and living standards have been decreased at the same time that the amount of work hours has increased. So in addition, the work of production and consumption and representation as well as analysis is still gendered, as has been pointed out. And this has many different kinds of consequences and effects, material and symbolic. For me, films that explore traditional women's work, shifts in the representation analysis and the nature of women's work, both in terms of ideas about the relationship between social reproduction and the care and maintenance of the home, of the daily aspects of life and community, of communication and care, as well as education, feed, you know, food, the raising of children, what Marx called unproductive labor and its relation to productive labor, have deep resonance with the contemporary scholarly debates and concern with how immaterial and cognitive labor, some of what the intellectual labor of theory that Lynn was talking about, is valorized, measured, and compensated. But these debates aren't merely academic, because the representation and analysis of work is crucial to being able to conceptualize labor in a way that can be both generalized and organized. And calling attention to the way in which labor is gendered is even more crucial to understanding how this labor is categorized and valorized, how it is and isn't compensated. So the number of films that are now interested in this exact category of affective labor are really fascinating, particularly in their dislocation. They're kind of the difficulty of their being able to be located as films about affective labor or and their relationship to actually the global. Because there's a kind of necessity to mix an interest in feminized labor or what was traditionally women's work or social reproduction with other political focuses. And this seems to me to demonstrate the kind of embeddedness of the category of something like the women's film, the designation of getting at something of a kind of continued exploitation, of a kind of continuation of exploitation. Though often it's precisely the absence of the ability to call something exploitation or oppression that we actually must consider in any sort of analysis or consideration of the conditions under which we live. So for me, filmmaking itself is a process that involves a lot of what is traditionally considered women's work. And so I want to contribute in this discussion to the category of the women's film, now a more nuanced understanding or appreciation of the gendering of certain aspects of the labor or work involved and represented in today's women's films or women's films. That could now also include kinds of stuff like precarious labor of care, of affective labor, and of connection. Or in the case of my own production work, to recognize that in the work of production, and specifically of documentary, the most central aspect of the labor, apart from fundraising, is precisely that of the production, and this is actually central to fundraising, is the production of relationships and of communication. It's cognitive labor. It's immaterial, even though, because you don't all see all the numbers of emails and phone calls and all the writing and thinking and reading and watching and talking that I do in the process of making a film to produce a project. So it's important to raise this point for me as a way of seeing what I do as a female filmmaker who's interested in this category of what was traditionally women's work. Because what we do, and what we all do here as critics, makers, viewers, because I want to foreground those aspects of my own work for my own benefit, like to take stock of the fact of how much I work in what I do, and not just poo-poo some of that work of connection for my own benefit, but also in my teaching and mentoring of younger artists and filmmakers, so as to call their attention to the more dialogical and affective aspects of the social experiment, which is media production, distribution, and consumption. And how it is precisely those aspects, that experimental aspect, as it were, which we may find, and I certainly do, most pleasurable in the process of making work. It's the most central to what I do and why I do what I do. I mean, I almost feel like it's part of the reason why I pick up a camera at all is as an excuse to be able to talk to people. But that in fact, that pleasure right in it actually masks some of the difficulty of the situation of my own economic precarity because of I enjoy that pleasure. That I am supposed to enjoy the fact that that's what I do, and it's supposed to compensate me in a cultural capital and fulfillment, whereas, healthcare is not provided until I came to grad school. So that alienation is is something that, by pointing out that that kind of precarity is something that I experience even despite my pleasure of making movies and also frustration at it, calling attention to that enables or opens up a space where to think about the kinds of connections and solidarity that are possible with other kinds of workers, so that we're not just singled out as this kind of the artist category, something sort of special, but that it opens up this other relation. And I think, interestingly, with scholars, but also with other workers worldwide.
I'm going to show 10 minutes of a film, but first I'll make a few comments. I'm pretty sure when I was invited to be on this panel, I said that I didn't want to be, but that I'd be happy to show a film. And then the poster came out, and I was on the panel. So one of the reasons I didn't want to be on the panel is that when I hear women's film or feminist film, the question that arises for me is there something in particular, special, formally, let's say, and conceptually about the woman's film or the feminist film. And I actually think, at least in the small group that I'm attached to, which would be the experimental film and video world, there has been some difference. So I thought that I wanted to share a little scientific note, which I might have dreamt, but I'm pretty sure I read in Science News, and I really like it anyway. I'm quite sure that I couldn't find it online last night, so maybe I dreamt it. But it was about using MRIs to compare female and male brains of mathematicians doing, so professional mathematicians doing the same problems. I know I read this, okay. I admit, I know I read this. And there's really something fabulous about the findings in this case, which was that in the male mathematician's brain, there were hot spots in a few areas, very focused, and in the female mathematician's brain, the whole brain lit up. And I just thought, well, there's something great about that. And so I won't take time trying to unpack it, but I will, when you watch what I hope you're about to see, you'll be able to unpack that a little bit, I think. So let's try. This is from an ongoing episodic serial called Let Me Count the Ways, and there will be 10 episodes in these. This is the first two. It would be great if we could turn some lights down. There's no sound.
で、家がなくなって、あと 活、まあ、設備に対して、まあ、政府はどんな便宜を与えてくれましたか？
今までだ。
まあ、当時のね、疎開した、まあ、まあ、旅行とかね、生活設備に対して政府はどんな便宜を与えてくれましたか？
運搬したようでございます。自分などは近いですから、自分に運びました。 maybe half an hour I could see downtown.
In other words, when you saw
very clearly, I mean it's clear that we see it.
You saw the castle burning.
Yes.
How far, how many minutes after the bomb hit,
was it? Well, maybe it was five. So I could just, well, you could see the flames.
Did you see any other white people after the bombing? Were there any other around you? And were or were they not burned?
Not one white person was burned. They were injured, not burned.
And you saw quite a few of them?
Yes, we saw the 3 days after.
Yes.
We saw everybody.
Were any of these white people nearer the center of town than yourself at the time?
Yes, we were the only ones out of town. Everybody else was in the town. We advised them, we told them, we'd take them with us and everything, but they said no. Don't need. Well, the missionaries, they thought that it was their duty to die with the Japanese, with German Catholics. But then the other people, we told them to, but then, oh, their garments and everything burned, you see.
Were there any of these white people that lost their hair at a later date?
No, nobody's injured in any way. That's why the Japanese, they just say it's a miracle, and it must be some kind of a trick to it, you know. They just won't believe us. There were 9 Russians, 1 American woman. Oh, she's American. I don't think she's French or something, but she says she's American. American, I believe. And I believe 12 Germans. German missionaries.
They were located in various parts of the town, some near or some in approximately the same distance as you people at the time they were.
Yes. About half.
Was there any visible change in the attitude of the people toward the war after the bomb fell?
Oh, they said that it was very inhuman, and that I suppose that we'd lost the war, and they said, oh, I suppose all the Japanese are going to be killed, and then we're going to live in the dugout, and oh, we're not going to just give up like this. Well, there were all various opinions. There were people who, right from the beginning, said we shouldn't have fought with the Americans. We shouldn't have fought with foreign people anyway. Because they consider anybody fighting, they're not. They think a white person is a very high, highly educated, something very much, much higher than himself. But some people, you see, they won't achieve to that. They try to live up to us if they can.
On whom do they place responsibility for the effects of these bombs?
I heard a rumor that said that America defeated Germany and that they took the bomb away from the Germans. See, the Germans had it ready to bomb New York and took it away from the Germans and used it on us. And they said the pilot was a German forced by Americans. And they saw us tied up in Hiroshima to a telephone pole and the Japanese people to death, they said. I never saw the German, or that was a rumor that I heard. You mean a criticism of the Japanese? Oh yes, very many criticisms. You see, the pirates, the radio locators, they said that that it worked very well because the airplanes fly over, and then the sirens would go. And on that day, the bombs were dropped, and there were no sirens to serve us. There's always a B-29 or 2 flying about, no sirens. They blame the people that took care of telling us when the enemy plane would be over. And they blame the government for not paying much attention to that. Oh, there were a lot of criticism. The whole Japan, I mean, all during the war there were criticisms, especially the military folks.
Did the government take any steps immediately following the catastrophe for rehabilitation? Did they send anybody in there, or were there any outside agencies that came in there immediately?
Oh, yes, from other towns. There were policemen, nurses, doctors, and engineers, everybody came.
discussion context. Just first of all, a lot of my work does deal with history and with non-linear representations of history and basically outside data, not the stuff that gets into most of the books. And also, I would generalize that to say that sort of extended history to culture, to pop culture. So those are two, okay, thanks, major areas of focus in my work. Now, I anecdotally want to comment that when I was a film student, I was at a senior high school, and there were all of these very loud mouths and with monstrous egos, who I do think would have been imprisoned or something if it had been 10 years later. So they're kind of, but they lay a groundwork for how this marginal area practice would be presented. And that's still pretty much in place today. It's starting to change through places like 16 Beaver and Light Industry. But I want to say that, so these men are Stan Brakhage, Hollis Frankton, Kenneth Anger, Peter Kabelka, and mostly what they did was they'd show their work and talk about what was wrong with the other people's work. That's pretty much how they talk. So then I saw one of Yvonne's films. She came. And it was just funny because the guys got really quiet.
Where is it?
Buffalo.
Oh.
Yeah, because see.
What did I show, the woman who?
Yeah. You know, because normally you have the show and then you'd all go get drunk and sort of be the older guys with the girlfriends, selected from their classes. But when Yvonne came, I think they were a little intimidated. And so I saw her work, and I'd also seen some of Joan Jonas's work. And I know I've told you this, Yvonne, that you were my role model. part of that, a couple of things happened. One was that you actually said you did not want to be called a woman filmmaker. And I know that that's been revised and everything, but I
thought I didn't deserve to be called a feminist filmmaker.
Oh.
Because feminists up to 1965, in my mind, were on the barricades, and I didn't see myself
okay.
as political in that way. But
so I misunderstood you in a way that was helpful for me. Because what I thought you were saying was that you didn't want your work to be labeled in a way that gave it a smaller place in the world.
I was never one of those. Like Jane
okay.
Campion was one of those.
Okay, yeah, well, I
didn't want to be marginalized as a, and there were a number of women who
yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, all right. So,
I
anyway, it doesn't matter that much.
Yeah,
creatively distorted the message. What I thought was okay, I'm a feminist, and these guys have made all this work, and it's important, it's really interesting, it's doing something that hasn't been done before. And the egos probably helved, because you're carving out new territory. But I also thought, well, good, they've taken care of this stuff. And now we can learn from it and we can move on. And I felt that the work that women like yourself and other younger filmmakers were doing, people like Sue Friedrich and Peggy Alwish, it was a lot, it tried to grapple with a lot more. So without suppressing that question of the form, they also were trying to talk about things in the world and issues. So that's my generation. And it's still a history that hasn't been properly written. The guys are still in charge, and P. Adams Sidney is one of the people who really has made sure that that's the case in his two books, in which only a couple women show up.
Scott McDonald has tried to.
Yeah. And other people are writing history differently. Mm-hmm. So I think that's all I'm going to say right now. Here, I just have to also mention that when I brought this film to my distributor, Women Make Movies, Debbie didn't take it because she said it wasn't a woman's film. Let me count the waves.
This comes up again and again, and I haven't been on a panel for quite a while in relation to women and feminist filmmaking. The difference in style and genres and money expectations, and as an example of this dichotomy that constantly rears its head, like there's this contrast between Yvonne, you speak of the dearth of black women filmmakers and women filmmakers in general in the industry, and Patty comes along and talks about the abundance of women filmmakers. So what is this about? And I should point out in that first issue of Camera Obscura, I started to argue. I remember the editors were trying to pin me to with these generalizations that experimental films and Brechtian techniques, strategies of distanciation, exposed social issues much more than conventional narrative films. And I kept bringing up, someone told me it was like the wolves and the rabbit. I felt chased. And Eustache's Mother and the Whore, which had been a very powerful film for me, very gender specific, about a guy who's torn between two women and all the problems around that. It was a very powerful film, and told with conventional acting and editing, etc. So I wasn't going to buy this experimental films are better than Hollywood or traditional narrative films. And so it comes up in relation to, Yvonne, you tend to emphasize that most of your women want to get into the industry. And my kind of filmmaking and Leslie's generation, I have no aspirations to this, and find alternative ways to, like I'm struck by in your 6 years and still she can't get her film produced. And I think if she thought differently about an alternative way to make it, she could do it. And the industry, you know, for those of us who came up in the 70s, 80s, with Women Make Movies and Women's Film Festivals, the industry was something we had a very specific argument with, and it was one of the motivating or generating things for me getting into film. I was going to deal with narrative, but not with professional actors, not with those conventional or traditional shot, reverse shot ways of making films. So, not that I thought that, I mean, I grew up with Renoir and I love all these films, and Michel Vigo and 30s and 40s Hollywood filmmakers. I mean, these were powerful influences, but I was not going to go there. And so this plethora and dearth argument keeps raising its head, and I think it has to be unraveled and addressed.
My work, I was focusing on feature films, but really Black women have made hundreds of documentaries, short films, multimedia work, definitely a lot of television. The reason that I was focusing on features is because if you're a feature, you don't know the names of documentary filmmakers or who directed the last episode of Glee or who is making the short films. If we are part of history and we're part of American popular culture in film, you are a feature film director. And so one, and that's why I was focusing that work that way and looking at, because you don't know women directors, even though, as Patty said, there are lots of them. It's just where we have been able to work kind of helps to ensure that you don't know us as directors. So that's kind of the answer to that. Yes, there's a lot of work, but just in the arena where, and even speaking to what Patty was talking about a little bit, when you start off on the festival circuit, is where women, where all filmmakers are established. But what's happened, because we don't have parity in these festivals. I mean, you know, I remember one year with Sundance, they were really excited, they called it the year of the woman. And it was 28% of the films were by women. It wasn't 50% or 51%. And that was so exciting for them. They couldn't believe they had so many films in the festival. And if you, that's where you start. And that's where the writing starts. That's where the criticism starts. That's where you review. That's where you have the potential to get picked up. That's where your career starts to grow and where you can actually have a life.
What year is that?
The year?
Places gatekeepers, or in my case, my project is also about features, and it was a weird thing. It's like, how am I writing about features when I care so much about documentaries and shorts and independent work? And I'm writing a book on global women filmmakers in the 21st century who make films, feature films that circulate mostly in festivals and art houses. And I thought I could hold something steady and constant by looking at that circuit and then think about all of the forces, the history of women's film culture, the divergent various histories of feminism, and these economic questions in relationship to that. But I keep having to insist that's not women's cinema.
I wanted to add one other thing. The other reason that we don't know a lot about women's work is that even women, particularly in the academy, often don't do the work. That we don't choose us as projects. We don't write about us. We rarely will take the time to write a book because it might not help our careers in the academy. So, and you can, I'm just making this comment that if you went and looked, you'll see that a lot of times what we'll end up doing isn't us. And if we're not going to do it, I don't know what to say.
Some of that work.
I hope
yeah.
so.
Does anyone else on the panel want to respond to anything that's been said before I open up to the audience? I just wanted to say one thing in response to Leslie. Hollis Frampton was very supportive of me.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. No, they brought you there. I think you were
yeah.
worshipped. But you had some power. That's what it looked like to me, a 21-year-old woman, that you had some power. You were different to them, and they behaved very well around you.
Oh, I guess I didn't know how badly they could behave.
When you try to teach
the 70s films, and you say, now you have to, like, the baseline is this, you know, anti-pleasure argument that, you know, I want to destroy this pleasure. Laura Mulvey says passionately, you know, just like, I have such pleasure in her prose, and I say, you see, it's in there anyway. Her figures of speech are so rich. But she's talking about a modernist aesthetic that I think is very alien in the era of proliferation of, you know, pleasurable media sources. And for me, teaching across that divide is really interesting and fun. It's not only excavating the history that I was sort of alluding to, it's showing up everywhere now, that it's become a style almost, this kind of 70s radical feminist, you know, out there art. But so it's historicizing the present as well. I think that makes it really important to say, like, you know, students will come in having seen a life-changing gay or feminist film, you know, when they were little. Yeah, that for me was just, you know, about those movements taking on steam. And to think about those changes in the industry and the politics and the pedagogy with them is a really, you know, fruitful thing that I like. And I just have one example of a fun collaboration. I can't remember the young woman's name, but Barbara Hammer introduced me to a young dyke. She said, we're making this movie together. And it was like, you know, 30 years difference in age. And they were going back and forth. They were, you know, making something. And I think Barbara was shooting and she was cutting, or there was something. So it was a very deliberate attempt to kind of have conversations around practice, real concrete stuff about those differences.
I mean, just as a quick response to that, too, I'd say, like, I think, again, to go to that in practice session that I was talking about that Cameron Screw's doing, I think it's, in some ways, exactly to try to address that, to try to show how these are all practices, like, not to kind of say, all right, what's going on now in YouTube production or media convergences or, you know, is totally different from what feminist, you know, but to say, no, like, it's people still working over the material of their culture, and to try to see them all as work now, just, you know, to try to, again, put those in dialogue with one another. I don't know if it always happens so easily, but I think it's important, you know, to consider all of them as sort of, yeah.
I think there's a question here.
Yes. So, Yvonne Weldon, you talked about this shift when it sort of became accessible or acceptable for Black directors to have white casts, and then Lynn, you talked about filmmakers, this accusation that female filmmakers are aping male directors, and then Professor Thornton talked about your film being rejected because it wasn't a women's film. So do you think it's even possible that there sort of becomes no difference between women's and men's films, and then do you see that as problematic, that if women use, like, there's no distinction between the two art forms?
Who are you addressing?
Yeah.
Oh, do I have to address anyone? I would like to hear varying opinions, I guess. Professor Thornton, you talked about your film being rejected, so do you see there?
Can I say a note about that?
Oh, sorry.
No, but it is sort of, there is something very specific that was about that I'm not happy about it when we make movies, but that has been a big shift in the market for experimental media. There's also been a shift with home video to making, and YouTube and things like that, making fiction, shorter fiction pieces, less easy to distribute to the educational market. So in some ways, although Women Make Movies had a mission and is a nonprofit to push the envelope, especially in the sort of cinema studies market, that there's been a sort of turn to documentary, to, you know, straight on documentary topics, and innovative style when it's there is great, but it's not a policy, but it is sort of looking down the line, is the movie going to do some business? Now, that's different from the is it about women or is it a women's film. Women Make Movies policy is by and about, so then that about becomes sort of the question that you're asking, like, so, you know, where do you see it? And I don't think that there's necessarily a women's cinema and a men's cinema, you know, from the get-go at all. And I do think you could have identical things made by, you know, if it's in an industry context, I could see very little variation. I mean, series television, you know, directors do a great job, but they might not put their stamp on it or whatever. So I think that that's, but whether it's worth looking through the lens of women's cinema at the range of work that's out there, I think it's still very much is.
Right. That's, I was just being very similar to Peter, that I don't think that, I would say for me personally, it doesn't seem like there's women's cinema or men's cinema, and I would sort of dispute that we can, but I think that it is important to look through the lens of sort of gender analysis and gender practices that affect both women and men and sexual sort of positioning, so that, you know, it's not so much sort of the identity of those forms as seeing how those kinds of force relationships or something make their way through all of culture, and that that's still, and you know, crucial to involvement.
Is The Hurt Locker a woman's film, a feminist film? What is it? It's a powerful film.
I'm kind of going to be like against all this. I think that women are really, really, every woman in this room is really a different person. And every woman in this room, if she made a film, it would be really different. Mm-hmm. And let's say the film's about a woman. Every woman is going to bring something different to the film. Now let's say if all the men in the room decided that they were going to make a film about the same topic. The fact that they don't have a woman's brain is probably going to, they can do all the research they want, they can do all the work they want, they can read up about the stuff, but because they did not actually have the lived experience of the women in this room, there may be something different in what they produce. I don't know what it would be in particular, but really, it is really different to be a woman in this world than it is to be a man in this world. And so I do believe that there really is a woman's film, but not a woman's film. There are very, very many different types, just like everybody in this room is different. But just having lived as a woman, you're going to have something that you're going to work. That's my opinion. I really believe that. And even to the point where, you know, let's say, and one of the things I want to make clear, because I think that's a good point about The Hurt Locker. So Catherine Bigelow goes and does a lot of research. She based this film on a young man's experience in particular. She did a lot of research, he actually worked with her to write the script. Because I believe that she should be able to make a film about men, which she does a lot. I think most of her films are male protagonist films. But it doesn't mean that just because you're a certain gender that you can't make a film about another gender. But I do, you get what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, so.
I would agree with part of that, yes. Men's experience in society is very different from women's, obviously. But when it comes to representation of that experience, we are influenced by things that, we have influences that cross these boundaries and these differences. And I guess I could amplify that. But let it be.
I don't know whether I can formulate the question well, but I want to know, because you saw Mr. Humans, I want to know how you position when you make your films. How do you position your film yourself with feminist theory? The reason I ask this is because in most cases, feminist scholars, you know, we do research on women's films and we can read some things at the film.
would say the Eric Gervais' writing is very important, and helping me to articulate to myself what it was that I was interested in. So that's a beginning of an answer. I've been frustrated by some of the journals and festivals devoted to women's film, because I do think the journals have tended to address mainstream cinema more than other kinds of work, and it might be really productive to try to articulate this other kind of work. So a few occasions I've asked some of the writers, hey, why don't you write about these kind of alternative films by women? And the answers have been things like, well, because this work is already self-theorizing, so we don't have to do that. And the more urgent, even though we love this work, but the more urgent mission is to produce an analysis of the position mainstream cinema.
The second wave of feminism gave me permission to explore subject matter that I might not have, and had I not been influenced by feminist readings, not necessarily theoretical, but all the sisterhood is powerful, all the complaining and demonstrating and protesting that began to happen in the late 60s, early 70s. And I guess that that positioned me in a certain way, and so that throughout, there are two currents that are characteristic of all seven features I've made. One is experimental strategies, I guess, the relation to live performance. I brought that from my dance background, but also my experience as a woman, from being a heterosexual to being a lesbian. Certain kinds of ambivalence and sexual conflict permeate all of my films in one way or another. And I would say this strand comes from feminist theory. Yeah.
When I started out, I was totally not into anything feminist or feminine, never occurred to me, was not interested in looking at feminism, I was like, these women want to work? I mean, black women have been working forever. So it's like, and that was really basic. I mean, I was really young and a college student and really kind of breaking it down to kind of the, basic way of seeing things. And I have to tell you, I kind of refused to accept the label for a long time because of the theory, the history with black women and feminism is not cute at all. And so, we had this whole black feminist thought that started coming up in the 80s and 90s, and which allowed a place for folks like me to enter into a conversation and to think about myself as a feminist. But I have to tell you honestly, when I'm making a film, that's not in my head at all. But it turns out the way my film practice would definitely be considered feminist film practice if you broke down, like just the way. So for instance, like with Ruth Ellis' film, we worked together on the film. We decided what it was all we working together. We decided what it was going to be about, what her strategies were. She was involved. I had scripted narrative scenes within the film. We worked on them together. She was involved in the shooting of everything involved. I do not believe in structures in filmmaking. Everybody, I don't care what your position is, if you're the production assistant or the producer, we can't make the film without either person. So even just the structures in the way I work, anyway, I'm just saying, I'm not really thinking about, is this a feminist practice? But probably if you looked at what I was doing, you would say that I am definitely engaging in feminist film practice in my work. Oh, yeah, I'm definitely, because I'm focusing on women. Although I did decide to do an experiment, and I decided to produce a film by a white man to see what that was like. And we can talk about that another time. It was actually, I did decide to do that, just to see.
Yeah, just briefly, I think that feminist, I definitely consider myself a feminist, and since like age 5, when my brother got to go out and farm with my grandfather and I had to do housework with my grandmother. So I came back and talked about the stereotypes to my mother and said, I'm never going there again. So feminist from 5, and that's definitely informed all of my thinking and working. I think, interestingly enough for me, feminist film theory was not as central to my upbringing or development at all. What was important was feminist theory, and like sort of so things like Simone de Beauvoir and that whole lineage, and then I would say two of the most important things I've ever read are Juliet Mitchell, and then I would say Joe Freeman's The Tyranny of Structurelessness, which is interesting that Yvonne just mentioned that. That actually ends up to be probably the most important piece in my own understanding of the practice. And of the relations, that there's always a structure at work, and that the process is by becoming conscious of it, making it clear, and finding ways to make it democratic, and recognizing the gendering in it. In terms of, it's actually interesting, I think that I was told by a kind of Daniel Eisenberg, who was at the point chair of the, he's a male filmmaker, experimental filmmaker, I remember talking about some sort of hierarchical issue and whatnot, and as I was starting to make my film, and he said, there's only one eye behind the camera. And he said, it's absolutely essential that you are the director and all of this kind of stuff. And it was actually extremely helpful, because at that point I started to really think about the structure of how I was going to relate, and it's changed every time I started a project. One of the things that I committed to doing was, even though I was collaborating with other people, I made sure to pay everyone who worked with me, because as being the single director of my film, that was really important to me, that I was not taking other people's labor without both compensating them, you know, monetarily and on a byline. Difficult to watch. I know a lot of people
through festivals. Festivals are an opportunity for to reach a larger audience. Museums are another place where an audience is cultivated. So, I mean, that's a very relative thing. I've always accepted the size or the specialization of my audience. I mean, I never expected to be shown in the Cineplex, you know. So it's in film schools and museums and sometimes a gallery and an art house. That's where my audience is. And now there's Ubu.com that pirates my films, and I'm perfectly happy with that.
And you know what? I think a lot of it has to do with who writes the history. So, like for instance, Patty just brought up the fact that she's like, oh, this film Will, you know, by Jesse Maple, oh, they're restoring it. Well, what happened was in the 80s, I think she was 80, and a woman named Kathleen Collins Prettyman came out with a film called Losing Ground in 1981. Now really, Jesse Maple's film was first, but Kathleen Collins Prettyman, she taught somewhere here in New York, I mean, not here, but in New York. She went to this film. Her film centered on a woman who was a philosophy professor. She was looking at so many wonderful issues that academics would love to write about. And she was part of that world. And for the longest, that was considered the first feature film from this period, this modern period, or the second wave, you know, post the race films in the 50s. That was considered the first film by a black woman. Jessie Maple grew up on a farm in Mississippi. She is, well, you all may have seen her in my film. She's not articulate in the way that Kathleen Collins Prettyman was or is, or, well, Kathleen Collins Prettyman has passed away. But I think sometimes what's written about, and that work, that early work from the 70s that was privileged because certain people decided that that was going to be what was written about, and that was going to be curated, and that's what, you know, and really that's why we have, to me, that's why we have that history. And now there's a lot of work being done, so now Will's being pulled up and restored, and you know, I mean, Jessie Maple's career is amazing, what she did, but you know, she was the first camera woman. She fought ABC, she took ABC, CBS, and NBC to court so that she could be a camera woman, and that's why we have camera women. But the thing is, this woman was not, like I said, she was from Mississippi. She kind of had this way of speaking where a certain assumptions are going to be made about her. And so, therefore, she's not, we don't know about her, but we know about Kathleen Collins Prettyman. And so I think that's also what happened with this work, that you're kind of saying, well, it's a little inaccessible. Well, some people decide that they love that work, and that's why we know about it today, and we don't know about some other. That's my opinion, but I'm just...
I just want to add that when, let's say, Riddles of the Sphinx and some of these other films came out, they were riveting and not so difficult because there was a context. And I don't know how, I hadn't seen Riddles of the Sphinx for decades, and I don't know how I feel about it now. I do think it would be a hard sell now, but there really was an intellectual and artistic context for that work and that kind of work at the time.
I think also you were probably encountering it through a pedagogical situation. So there's, you know, I don't think out in the world women's cinema is associated with Riddles of the Sphinx at all. Like, I have to, like, excavate the fact that Laura Mulvey was a filmmaker
one 360-degree pan is enough. To say that she made that film in that context of a film practice, you know, because her work has been so canonized, it seems like this was some professor writing it somewhere, as opposed to like somebody actively making art. Now, on the other hand, I do show Jean Dielman in every class.
She's awesome.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
I show it to just the regular film class, and, you know, it holds up in ways that, but I do think those are different aesthetics. But I think, you know, what would you say, Jane Campion? You could have a really, like, bright star. Why didn't it get enough? I mean, I don't feel like it didn't get enough conversation around how it sort of cut across women's genre stuff and then the sort of, you know, auteurist part that was her and sort of rethinking authorship in terms of, I don't know, but that was felt victim, I think, to the same, you know, sort of market logic and visibility logic that Yvonne W. outlined so well in relationship to Buckley's work. So.
Can I just add that Riddles of the Sphinx is playing tomorrow at 4 at the Campbell Carson? <Yeah. laughs>
Oh, yeah, I mean, Yvonne, you kind of spoke about this, but I mean, I wanted to know, and Lynn, you alluded to viewership and fandom, so I wanted to know how can we begin to conceptualize and trace a history of an audience for women's films? And I was thinking about you, Yvonne, when you were doing your talk and how, and we were talking earlier about, you know, where are the black women cinema goers? Well, they're going to see Tyler Perry films. So I guess I'm thinking about how can we conceive of an audience for women's films with this kind of splintering of an audience as well.
I just cite Jackie Bobo's work on Daughters of the Dust alongside The Color Purple, because she does this, you know, what I think is one of the best sort of kind of reception studies, because she looks at black women's networks for reading a film that was kind of difficult, Daughters of the Dust, and in terms of all kinds of other, you know, the novels that it's based on. I mean, the novels with which it's in dialogue, and compares that to reactions to a film that was otherwise somewhat reviled, The Color Purple, but which was also prized because of its relationship to Alice Walker's text or whatever. So that's just one study.
Mm-hmm. And I firmly believe that women have to build a fan base. So, and you know, we were talking about this yesterday, that Tyler Perry, you know, spent years failing, and by year 6, he kind of got his little formula right, and that was with the plays, and then he moved to the films. But in that time period, he built an email list of 400,000 names that really, how many women filmmakers have? And this is before the United States had broadband penetration. So this is still when you were still getting that. Remember when you dial up and you get that noise? Okay, so, and this was still before, and you know, you heard of the digital divide. I mean, that man still had 400,000 names 5 years ago. So really, if we want, and let me take one step back. Probably, I'm gonna say it was about 10 years ago, there was a group called the First Weekenders Club. There was a black one that did really well, and that one started having black films open number one at the box office. It was this huge like chain thing that went around. Email, phone call, you have to go to the opening weekend. There was one started for women also, which I don't think exists anymore.
I keep trying to find it because I used to always put my students get on it, and I don't think it is anymore. Women in Hollywood is the only one. You get films and theaters.
So I tell my students right now to start building their fan base. So, and you can start with your Facebook group. Really, there's a really great article called 1,000 Fans, and you can just Google 1,000 Fans, but it really looks at, because to me, this is the first time, I don't care who you are, that you can actually make a living as an artist. And this 1,000 Fans, theory is that you cultivate this group of 1,000 fans, and they basically commit to spending about $100 a year on you, on your production. And Yeah, you know, you could go from 5,000, but you know, but or you can, you know, start at a lower number, but it's never too early to start building. You've heard about compounding interest in your bank account. Okay, so it's never too early, and this is an amazing moment because it's the first time you can do it. You know, Facebook is what, 2003, and it went mainstream 2006. That's like 4 years ago. YouTube is about how many years old now? 4 years old? 5 years old? It's not even that old. So this is the first time you can build a fan base. So people are kind of, you know, thinking about Tyler Perry in a way, but he actually made a commitment to black women 10 years ago. Well, maybe 12 years or 13 years ago now, where nobody else was doing that. And he kept failing and he didn't care. And he just stuck by his commitment. So really, I think that's what we have to do. You know, you decide what your fan base needs to be. It could be 5 people if you're not that concerned about earning a living that way. Or it can be greater, but it is up to you. And there's a lot being written right now about artists and the fact that we have changed as a society, and there is an expectation that we will engage with our fans, which, you know, what you were talking about with, like, Lady Gaga is a great example. But, yeah, you got to talk to them, basically.
And can I just add real quick to that? Because, I would also say, I think that that's hugely important, but I also think it's important to really recognize that there are multiple kinds of publics out there, and sometimes getting an enormous public is really important. Sometimes the value of a public is precisely that it's not enormous. Sometimes the fact that you're having intimate conversations within a subculture, within a particular group, you know, is equally as important. So I don't think that the benchmark should only be, you know, is something going to be hugely popular. It's obviously that's a crucial area to work in, but it's equally crucial to work in recognizing that, you know, small publics are all, that has a power of its own that's equally as important to try to maintain and to validate.
Leslie and I would like to let everyone know that if you'd like to support either of us for $100 a year, or more, I'm sure Yvonne and the both Yvonnes would welcome that. Maybe you could even do that for your favorite theorist, too.
But we definitely need it. I'm going to go home and sell up my fan base. There is a reception at 155 George Street.
No, it's right there.
Oh, it is?
Yes.
It's not at 155 George Street. Oh, no, it's right there. Okay, it's right here. It's coming to meet you.
You just have to go up and
around the maze.
Well, it's not right.